Welcome to Shades of Green, Austin's live green talk radio show with your hosts John Hoffner, Reed Sternberg, and Stacy Gibry.
We are live each Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. here on KOOP Hornsby, Austin, 91.7 FM and streaming live at koop.org. Join us on Facebook or you can check out podcasts or previous shows online at shadesofgreenmedia.com.
The views expressed here are not necessarily the views of KOOP Radio, its board of directors, volunteers, staff, or underwriters.
Today we're going to be talking about the Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People. It's a book by David Todd and Jonathan Ogren. And hopefully I've got the Ogren part right, but we'll be talking with them here in just a few minutes. And the book is basically about exploring conservation and ecology in Texas, presenting a highly visual and deeply researched view of the widespread changes that affected the state and population. Well, cool. So who wants to kick off our conversation today? Amy, do you want to tell us a little bit about
We're talking a little bit about this new book that's out, The Texas Landscape Project by David Todd and Jonathan Ogren. And they're actually going to be doing a little book signing, book speaking event tonight at Book People. So there's even more opportunity to learn more about them. And they have the book here. It's this beautiful illustrated story kind of all about conservation and ecology in Texas. And so maybe I want to give David a chance to just introduce yourself real briefly. How did you end up here today? You know, what got you involved in this world?
Well, thanks for asking and for including us on your show. We really are delighted to be here, Jonathan and I. So this started about 20 years ago with a group that we started called the Conservation History Association of Texas, which is a very, very long title for a very small group. But our focus back then and till now has been on environmental history, trying to understand the deep roots and complex stories behind environmental movement here in the state, whether we're talking about land or water or air or public health. And our first effort was oral history archive, a bunch of videos with veteran conservationists in the state, and it came out as a book called The Texas Legacy Project, Stories of Courage and Conservation. And that was about 6 years ago. And our editor at Texas A&M Press was nice to ask us if we might consider doing a sequel. And so that's the origins of this current book, The Texas Landscape Project, Nature and People, because we decided to go from the spoken word to audio perspective of conservation in the state and look instead at kind of a visual and geographic approach to try and understand these same questions of how Texas can be protected and restored, for critters and for people.
Sounds like two books that go great together. And I know that always helps for me to get the visual. You know, having pictures really helps me.
Yeah, a picture book for adults.
Right, exactly.
And so, Jonathan, how did you end up getting pulled into this project?
Well, I'm definitely a visual thinker. I love seeing visuals. David and I started working together on another couple projects maybe 6-7 years ago. And he had the idea for the Texas Landscape Project. And what I do is I make maps, I look at spatial relationships, analyze spatial data, so layering geology, soils, hydrology, vegetation, human use on top of each other, and trying to understand what does that all mean, what's related to what, why in low-income areas is there an education gap, why is there road access in one area and not road access in another. And David's idea of looking at a statewide assessment of environmental issues was just a dream come true for me, so being able to work on this project integrated really well with the other types of work I was doing.
Okay, now it makes a lot of sense why both of you are the authors of this book, a great combo.
And what about this nature and people concept? I think a lot of times conservationists tend to be in one camp and, you know, you have people who work on social issues in another. How do these two connect? What made you want to bring them both together in this book?
Well, I think Jonathan put it well, that there's this layering that's going on in Texas. You know, you've got ecoregions and aquifers and watersheds and all the sort of panoply of natural aspects of the state. But then as an overlay on that, we've got all the built world, you know, whether it's our houses or our offices or or roads or dams or canals. I mean, there's just a whole array of things that are part of our world now. So we have this natural world and we have this artificial world, and they do collide. And in some ways, we hope that we can also engineer some of these kind of, we call them improvements, to be restorative. You know, a lot of the stories in this book are really about the successes in trying to bring back the natural environment. So we're hoping that there's both a story here about the conflict and controversy and the drama of environmental protection in the state, but that there's also some really hopeful signs of what can be done to bring back good parts of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned collide. I guess the concept is they don't always have to collide, the things that we build, our built environment and the natural environment, right? So what you're talking about is that there are solutions that make it so we can coexist.
I like the word integrate.
Integrate.
So thinking about how we use land and integrating that with natural systems is a lot of what ideally would come out of people looking at this layers, looking at the complexity in more detail. And just adding on to it a little bit, since two vacation stories were already told, many, many years ago I went on a vacation and I had the opportunity to go through a human rights museum. And it was about Eastern Europe, Checkpoint Charlie Museum, and the last exhibit was about the environment as a human right, and that really just struck me as something new and a new concept. And thinking about the pride that Texans have in their landscape, thinking about how much we identify ourselves with our landscape, and thinking about that's something that we're totally relying on. No matter how far we displace ourselves or how high up in a building we are, we're still getting our water from the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. And understanding that we're integrated into that system and it's something that we take pride in and rely on is something ideally that drove what we're doing here.
So. Well, so we're talking kind of the environmental justice piece of the conversation there, right? And Texas doesn't always have the best history when it comes to
it's an understatement. Yeah,
it doesn't when it comes to the history of Texas hasn't always put that first. And so I would think that when you're trying to overcome one of the more adverse climates for something, it's good to understand the history of why it is the way it is or how it got to be the way it is. So I mean, how it seems like that's an important tool in understanding navigating the climate is to understand the history of how it got to be that way.
I think that's really accurate. We were struck time and again by how old some of these stories are that are on the top pages of our newspapers and the lead stories on radio or TV.
Yeah.
You go back to there's a really interesting story about the desert bighorn sheep and the effort to recover it out in West Texas, because it really went extinct here in the state in the late 50s. And if you start to track it back, you understand that some of the pressure on these sheep really began in the 1600s. We're talking about over 350 years ago, when miners out there were taking salt back to Mexico. And they would shoot these desert sheep or try to track them down and use them for food. And then there was mining that happened in the 1800s, silver and tin and some other metals out in the Trans-Pecos. And again, people shooting these sheep.
Yeah. Just for sport, is that right? Or were they actually packing them up and bringing them back with them to eat?
Feed the miners. And then later on you have railroads being built out there in the 1880s. And again, the sheep are shot. And then in the 1930s, you start bringing in these domestic sheep. And that sort of sealed their fate. And so we saw the sheep pretty much eradicated.
Yeah.
But then you have another 50 years since that time, since the late 50s. And we've seen these sheep being restored really successfully. So
not extinct quite.
No,
close to, but being brought back.
It was a very close call.
Yeah.
And they brought replacement sheep from other states, and so now there's a really viable population out there in West Texas.
Uh-huh.
So it's a great success. But to really understand the whole scope, you have to go back 350 years. So there's a lot of background to these stories that we're hoping that we can bring out in the Texas Landscape Project.
What prompted that shift for when people started actually, shifting from, okay, we're just kind of using these animals for our own purposes to wanting to bring them back in your research? What kind of made them change the mindset?
Well, I think there's some really... I guess some causes you could look at. Rachel Carson's book that came out in the early 60s, Aldo Leopold's book, Sand County Almanac, which came out before that. I think, started to change people's attitude about conservation, and it started to make people think that this is an important thing to take care of our planet. And then you start getting things that are more structural. You know, you get state wildlife agencies such as Texas Parks and Wildlife being set up, Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So you start having staff that are experienced and trained who can go in there and, in the case of the sheep, understand their biology and the ecology that supports them. Mm. And manage to help restore these animals to the Texas landscape.
So are they particular to Texas, or are they a sheep that were from elsewhere and brought in?
That's a really good question. There are subspecies of these desert bighorn sheep, but they're quite similar. So the sheep that we now have in Texas were actually imported from California, Nevada, other areas of the sort of desert southwest.
So it seems like it's tough to bring back a sheep population or improve an issue when you don't really know the history of it. And so I would not have known that there was an issue or that these sheep were even there 50 years ago, you know? So it's an important to have that history.
And what about with water? I know, I'm sure that's a big one that you guys have traced as far as subject matters in your book. Is there a good story that kind of jumps out to you as far as this water conservation history?
Well, if you wanted to bring it really local, focused on water, David mentioned Rachel Carson. She published Silent Spring in 1962. Hmm. In 1961, there was a huge fish kill in the Colorado River, affected Austin. It's a case study within Silent Spring. That's something a lot of folks don't know in Austin, and we should know about that. 10 years later, we have redemption starting. We have Lady Bird coming on, a number of city council members and other people really interested, thinking about what is the Colorado River, what is Town Lake to us. Yeah. And they decided to make that a place where people come together, started restoring it, started making it a place where people could enjoy nature. And now that work is still being carried on now today by the Trail Foundation, where they're looking at those 200 acres right around Lady Bird Lake and thinking, okay, we've moved forward, we've started planting plants. What is it for it to be biodiverse? What is it to be ecologically functional, aesthetically beautiful for the citizens of Austin? So that work is carrying on, and that deals with both water restoration, ecological function, and it goes from degradation to restoration.
And what do you see as far as that history informing what's happening now? I know there's a big concern in Austin that we have this really strong environmental past, but I hear a lot of concern, especially amongst current environmental activists, that we might not have that now or into the future. You know, have you seen, do we need another big awakening like that, or another, you know, ladybird figure to come along? Do you see, you know, what are we at now as far as our needs in a big environmental space?
It's troubling and encouraging. Okay. You know, I think that there are different ways of looking at this. I think that there's frustration from a lot of quarters about the ability of the federal government and the state government to really be effective. But I think, on the other hand, I'm seeing a lot of folks that are, you know, really empowered as individuals. And you know, maybe the kind of power that they choose to use in their house, you know, that they've chosen to use hydropower and wind power, for example. Or it may be the fact that they choose to be involved in citizen science. In other words, when they go out birding, that they might report the birds that they see, how many and what kind and where and when, to eBird, which is run out of Cornell University. Or it might be that they are interested in butterflies, and so they start tagging butterflies and reporting where they're found so they can understand more about the migrations of these butterflies. So I think that there's, you know, there's some worry about the funding and the regulatory powers that we've got on the governmental side. But then on the other hand, there's, I think, a lot of encouraging news that individuals are getting educated and empowered to get engaged themselves.
And I think we see that as a really important aspect of all of the things that we talk about on Shades
of Green.
Yeah,
sort of this democratization of, you know, ideas or, you know, energy, and that you can produce your own and you can kind of remove yourself a little bit from the larger powers that be, I guess. And Jonathan, you want to chime in here?
Well, another great example, and I think almost anybody who's interested in environmental issues has to say we need to dedicate more funds, more resources to those issues. But another great example of a success in Texas is the land trust community. So we don't have that many public lands in Texas. If you look at the The land's dedicated to conservation for open space or parkland. It's somewhere around 1.5%. It's very low compared to other
states.
Yeah,
I'm a Northeasterner, and that was one of the first things I noticed when I moved here.
Yes, it's horrible.
Where are the parks?
But that's augmented, though.
But the land trust communities over the last 25 years or so have put about 1.5 million acres of land in some form of conservation. So,
what does that do to the percentage?
It adds, it's almost up to 1%.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, still Texas is not a big much. State. It's probably hard to move up.
but if you think about that, so if it's over a 25-year period and you move forward another 25 years and the momentum of that movement continues, it'll be larger than our actual public open space lands.
And what about the hill country area? I'm sure you guys covered that in your book. I know that's a big concern now is that, you know, it's this beautiful tract of land that's so unique and different, and that there is, as Austin grows and San Antonio grows, there's all this development. What kind of research did you do about the history of the Hill Country and kind of informing what that means for us going forward in the future of conservation in the Central Texas region?
Well, I think that just to riff off of what what Jonathan had said, this sort of private land trust conservation movement is really encouraging, not just for the lands that are being set aside and protected for the future, but also to, as I think George Cofer would say, keeping the country in hill country.
You know, right.
That you're preserving a culture of ranching and farming and sort of rural activities so that it doesn't just become a playground for urban people, but that it has its own distinct sustainable kind of culture that I think many of us have grown to love. So by using what's called a conservation easement, where you can protect land against development, but you can continue to use those as working lands, you know, whether you're running sheep or goats or cattle or you're growing crops, I think is a really wonderful way to keep families on the land and keep those kind of traditions going.
And those families then, my understanding of the easement is that they continue to own the land, but they've made a promise, basically, that they won't develop it or change it?
A legal agreement, right. Definitely more than a promise, but a legal agreement.
A strong promise. A pinky promise.
Well, that's exciting. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the Texas Landscape Project, a new book by David Todd and Jonathan Ogren. So I wanted to sort of look at a dichotomy of an issue is you're trying to protect land because you want to have people to enjoy it and be out in what we'd call wilderness. But you also have the parks where you want people to be able to appreciate that land. So they're almost like that. To me, that's a collision. If people want to go out and see the wilderness, but yet there's so many people all over it, like the
right,
national park.
We'll
ruin it. Yeah. And I heard an interesting story about Baxter State Park, which is up in Maine, where the original Baxter set that aside to be total wilderness. You couldn't bring cameras up to the top of the mountain there, and it was really, the idea was to be able to make it a place of wilderness. So is that an issue that you ran into of how people want to appreciate the land, but also want to be able to use it and be away from people? So it's kind of ironic that way.
Well, that's true, and I think one of the things that we've learned about land conservation in Texas is that a lot of the land that's set aside is actually out in West Texas. You know, you think of Big Bend State Ranch and Big Bend National Park, huge amounts of acreage, I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of acres. But that land is really not available for a lot of urbanites who live in the eastern part of the state, whether they're in Houston or Dallas or Fort Worth. And so one of the efforts, I think, for Texas Parks and Wildlife and other conservation efforts by, you know, private nonprofits has been to try to set aside land that's actually close to metropolitan areas so that folks who, you know, want to go out for a picnic or for a bike ride or a hike can do it just in the space of one day rather than hopping in a car or, to go, you know, 500 or 600 miles. Yeah.
So we're going to cover this at the end of the hour, but for our listeners that are curious what's going on tonight, the book is called The Texas Landscape Project, and tell us where they can find out more information and what's going on this evening.
Well, there's a website, texaslandscape.org, where they can find out more. And this evening, we'll be at Book People at 7 p.m. talking more about the book.
Okay, so an opportunity for a deeper dive. Will people get a chance to ask questions directly to you guys there?
Absolutely.
Cool. Okay, great. So do we need to take a break, John, or are we...
I think we should take a break.
Okay.
You're listening to Shades of Green, KOP 91.7 FM. When we're coming to you on the web at koop.org. And they
were wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.
Always great to have a guitar and a harmonica with Bruce Springsteen.
Yeehaw.
This land is your land. His version of it. So
another New Jersey guy.
Absolutely.
Gotta love New Jersey.
And the drummer, you know, lived on our street growing up. Max Weinberg. I don't know if I ever told that on. Yes, he was a neighbor and literally had a garage band. Before he was with Bruce Springsteen, he would play in his garage with his buddies.
And so you used to hear him?
We would sneak up and look in the window and hear them.
Because he's going to be famous someday. I'm going to check it out.
We knew it back then. Yeah. We didn't know Bruce yet. If you're just joining us, welcome. You're listening to Shades of Green. John Hoffner, Amy Stansbury, and Reed Sternberg in the house. And our Stacy is a little bit sick today. I guess it's the...
she's taking up the hacking today.
But yeah, allergies are hitting her. But we're talking about the Texas Landscape Project, a new book by David Todd and Jonathan Ogren. Welcome again to the show. And tell us again about the signing tonight. There's a place where people can find out more about the book and get signed copies.
Yes, we will be at your friendly local independent bookstore, Book People, and we'll be there at 7 o'clock tonight, and we'd love to see people and talk more about the book.
Yes, and it is a really nice, I'll say it looks nice.
It's beautiful.
A beautiful book. And I guess I wanted to go back to one question. You had talked about the earlier book, which was the Texas Legacy Project, right? And you said there's some 200 videos associated with that? And how do people find out how get those or see them? Or
sure. From 1997 to 2008, we did about 230 interviews with scientists, engineers, ranchers, farmers, politicians, local activists.
All the people on the cover, and that's what I think is so cool about it. You're talking about land, but it's focused on people in the video. So
the top layer,
exactly. I mean, I think our hope was to recognize and celebrate these people who had committed their lives to environmental protection in Texas, and as anybody who's listening to this show knows, that's not the sure road to fame and fortune.
No, not at all.
So I think that this is just some small token of respect for these people that have contributed so much to conservation. And so that first book, Texas Legacy Project, was an effort to recognize them. And then there's a companion website that has about 450 hours of both raw and edited excerpts from those oral history interviews.
And what's that website there?
It's called texaslegacy.org. And then we have all the sort of tangible archival stuff at the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas if people want to see the raw records.
Great. Fantastic. And so now I know with this book, the Texas Landscape Project, we were talking before the break, that a lot of it is focusing, again, on people and the natural environment and a lot about environmental justice issues kind of over the years leading into now. And I know this is an issue that's been on the minds of a lot of people in Austin lately. We've had quite a few shows about various environmental justice issues in this city. I know that just yesterday, TCEQ, our Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, approved an expansion permit for a coal mine out in on the border of Texas. Yep, U.S. and Texas. And Sierra Club was really protesting that hard, along with a bunch of Native American groups there on the border. It was quite the blow for those organizations.
Wow.
Today. The issue, and again, it's the same kind of issue of people versus the land and companies and these big environmental issues. Basically, there's a lot of concern that the coal operation can, infect the water supply there for these local indigenous populations. Mm. And the real kicker is that the coal is actually so low grade that the U.S. doesn't allow people to burn it here, so it just gets shipped immediately across the border to Mexico. So it pollutes the water here, yeah, for people living in Texas, and then we don't even use it in this country. We just ship it right over.
That's just great.
Right. So it's kind of like the epitome of these environmental justice issues of who, you have to look at who's living on these border towns and how are they affected and what is their voice here in Austin. And I think it's pretty low.
Yeah.
And so I'd love to hear I know that these issues are not new by any means, especially in Texas, where, long a industrial kind of state. What are some, examples from history where we've had some of these environmental issues in town? Either of you guys want to share?
Yeah, I might be able to give a few examples. And I think that the big picture is just what you said, that I think a lot of us benefit from perhaps the energy that comes from carbon 1 and 2 or from other, from smelting metals,
right,
or,
but we never
or
see
from
it.
Plastics.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who live in the neighborhood, who live down the street, who live next door to these plants or these mines, who really get a disproportionate impact from, the kind of high-tech sources of energy and metals and so on that support our modern lifestyle. And so one of the things we tried to do in the book was to point out that there are these problems between industry and communities and basically environmental justice problems. And there's a number of examples. I'll give one, and then maybe Jonathan can jump in here and talk about some more. One of the ones that always occurs to me is that there's something called an upset emission, which is basically like a belch from a refinery or a petrochemical cracking plant, where there's something that goes wrong in the industrial process, and so there's a chemical problem, and so they have to let off steam in a sense and release pressure from the process, and so raw chemicals go out into the air or even into the water, and it affects all the people who live in the immediate area, mm-hmm, and there's not a really good regulatory system for protecting against these because a lot of them are really unpredicted or unexpected. And so you get these sort of environmental justice problems, which may be in Beaumont, Port Arthur, or in Corpus Christi, where there are a lot of these very large industrial plants. But then you also get them out in the Midland and Odessa area, because a lot of the natural gas plants out there and the compressor stations, they also have these belches and burps and so on. And I don't mean to minimize them, because they're really, some of them have benzene and really toxic stuff.
Yeah.
But these effects are really disproportionate to the people that are nearby. And I think that, there have been these traditional concerns about landfills and other kinds of environmental justice problems that we've had right here in Austin. You think about the Hornsby Bend problems and
The tank farm.
And the tank farm.
Yeah, sure.
We're no stranger to that here in Austin. And I think that this is a theme that we tried to explore in the book. And maybe Jonathan can give some other examples.
Well, a great example that comes to mind is the Sarco chimney in El Paso. Over time, they were able to show that there were increased levels of lead, both in the soil and in the blood of people that lived around it. So, yeah, you think about all the publicity that's happened recently in Michigan as a result of lead issues. That's also happened in Texas.
And explain for people who don't know, what's the Sarco chimney?
It was a lead-producing factory.
And a smelter?
A smelter. And mm-hmm. When did it operate from?
Gosh, from the late 1800s. So for over 110 years, and just a few years ago, the chimney was pulled down, and it was, I think, over 800 feet tall. It was an enormous part of the El Paso landscape.
Wow. So in addition to this being a justice issue and disproportionate impact, it's also about the total cost of these energy sources, and we often talk about that on the show, that we're not always calculating the true impact and the true cost of that source of energy, as opposed to, say, solar, John would chime in, or wind, or other, alternative energy sources. And they're getting passed on to others, those costs, the health impact, et cetera, but they're also not even being tabulated. They're not even being considered as part of the mix. Well, I think that's true.
And just as another sort of example of environmental justice and some of these kind of uneven impacts, one thing that occurs to me are the 180 major water reservoirs have been built in Texas since the 1950s drought. And, you know, a lot of these reservoirs have been built in rural communities where you've got ranchers and farmers that typically have not had a really strong political voice in the system. And they're seeing their ranches or farms submerged. And in some cases, you know, you also see the loss of bottomland hardwoods and a lot of sort of ecological riches that we're fortunate to have in Texas, but a lot of them are 30, 40, 50 feet underwater
and
now.
Some of which have a chain reaction to other parts of the ecosystem, too.
Yeah, exactly. It affects the estuarine inflows along the coast. And so there are a lot of issues with replumbing the state so that we can have, you know, beautiful, clean water coming out of our taps.
Is that official? I like that word, replumbing.
it's a good analogy, though, yeah. Because that is, as we move more to our cities, we do kind of have to replumb, I guess, figure out how to get water to us, you know, now that we're living kind of in different areas than traditionally.
Without the lead, of course, that plumb
stands for. Yeah, that would be preferable.
Right.
And so what about this energy piece? I know that you guys said you've done a lot looking at the wind industry and sort of this shift in, you know, of course, Texas is, of course, known to being an energy production state, and now we're doing a lot in wind. Jonathan, I know you have a story about when you're researching this.
I have a story from just this weekend. Uh-huh. I got a small vacation. I got to go up to Pecos, New Mexico, when I saw some bighorn sheep. Incredible. Mm. On the way back, coming through Sweetwater, Sweetwater's sign coming back into their town is now a windmill blade.
Wow.
It says, "Welcome to Sweetwater," on a windmill blade. And the landscape is changing. And so there's a lot of positive there. We have the highest potential for wind energy in the United States, and we're producing the most right now. I believe there was one day this summer where 40% of our energy was coming from renewable energy.
I think it was even maybe a little higher. Maybe 50% is the number I heard.
Okay. Yeah. Well.
40s to 50s, let's say. Maybe it was rounded up. Maybe it was 45, and they said 50%.
John's like, 50, 50.
Yeah.
No,
but
I hear 60.
That was an exciting day.
And as you already know, there's a lot of advances going on in solar. That's something that we didn't have enough data on to cover in this book. But the wind and solar industry are really escalating.
Constantly changing, too. Your book might have been out of date if you'd published that info.
That's exactly right. Now there's also something to consider as well, is there's negative sides to these
right.
Transmission coming from these high wind potential areas back to these urban areas. And so they're going across the landscape. And again, we need to think about this in a more complex way. How can we have the least impact on the landscape as we're moving from these relatively pristine areas back to the urban areas? And that's something we also addressed.
Hmm. And I guess another aspect that Jonathan was talking about was with the downsides of you know, a pretty good thing, the wind power, is that a lot of these wind turbines that have been sited recently in South Texas are along the major central flyway for millions of birds that are coming up out of Latin America and going towards Canada. And you know, there's a lot of concern that these windmills, which some people have called the sort of Cuisinart of birds, that birds can run
That's
into
an
these
image.
Blades and be turned into mincemeat. And so, you know, there are concerns that even with things that I think a lot of people in the environmental community have worked very hard to see, and, you know, having these renewable sources of energy, but there's often a difficult side to these things, and we really have to think through it. And I think we're hoping with the Texas Landscape Project that we can start visualizing these efforts and problems by seeing where these windmills are, and they do, in fact, overlap some of these flyways.
Yeah, have you seen people... Has there been much action around this as far as how to have the two coexist, windmills and the birds?
I think there have been efforts to try to figure out ways to site these windmills and also to turn them on and off during times of peak migration.
Okay.
But the traffic lights are not going to work.
Exactly.
Another example is bats, and I think they're looking at textures on the top of windmill blades to address bat issues as well.
Yeah, bats are really an important issue with wind. And they just had, I just heard a story about that where they're looking at special textures that somehow, I don't know what it does, but the bats will see that, or not see it, but radar off of it somehow.
Yeah, echolocate off of it.
Yeah, exactly. And
hey, I like that. That's the actual word.
I think it is.
Echolocate.
Yeah. It's what's interesting is that those wind turbines, again, they look like they're moving really slow. But if you look at the tip speed of those, they're going between 200 and 400 miles per hour.
Wow.
So that's why it's an issue with birds.
Wow.
You know, the birds, yeah, you think, again, you look at it, it looks like it's just lazily turning. But if you calculate that radius and how fast it's actually going by revolution,
interesting.
It's pretty fast. Yeah. So it's an interesting issue. Well again, we're with the authors of a new book, The Texas Landscape Project. And David Todd and Jonathan Ogren are going to be at tonight?
Book People tonight at 7 o'clock.
And you'll have copies of the book, I'm sure. And it's a beautiful book, and we're talking about it today. And so we're happy to have you guys with us. So tell us another interesting story. And maybe, I don't know if it was covered in it. I obviously haven't been able to read the book because it just came out. But one thing that I was always interested in, and my wife has been here, she's been raised in Austin, the horny toads. Do you talk about those? Because they, to me, are an interesting history. They were prevalent in Austin, and now they're gone, from my understanding.
I think that's true, and I've heard some people speculate that it's related to fire ants. Poor fire ants get blamed for a lot of things.
Nobody likes them.
Yes, right. I can think of some reasons to blame them.
Well, it's the first time I've heard them referred to as the poor fire ants.
Yeah.
They have a story too, though, I'm sure.
Well, they do, and I think it's interesting because it's the basics of the story are that the fire ants are believed to have arrived from South America in the 1930s, and they'd come ashore in Mobile, Alabama, on a ship, and they came in and they moved into Texas in probably the late 50s. Mm. And part of our little book is tracking this kind of exploding population of the fire ant and how it moved across Texas. It went some 550 miles over about 50 years. It's wow. Now in a majority of counties in the state. And
that's pretty fast when you think about how little they are.
I know.
11 miles a year.
Right, exactly.
As a group, yeah.
We tried to figure out, why it was that they could move so quickly. And there are some really interesting adaptations that they had, the kind of queen structure they had and the kind of federated ant pile.
So their system of government was conducive to
exactly
manifest destiny.
Well, apparently they had a kind of free pass where they, a fire ant could go by another pile and not be attacked by those. And that's not characteristic of a lot of other ants.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh,
interesting.
And then the other part about it that's really interesting to me is that there have been efforts over the last 30, 40 years to try to use insecticides to try to reduce the spread of these fire ants. But there's been a lot of recent research that suggests that it had the absolute opposite effect, because those same pesticides hit a lot of the native ants that were some of the natural rivals.
Cleared the way for them.
Right, and so to get back to the question is, maybe the horny toad's demise was in some ways related to the attacks of these fire ants, which had impacts on lots of other creatures from, white-tailed deer to calves, and then to lots of ground-nesting birds.
Wow.
So it's
very complex, these natural systems.
Well, and that's part of what we were trying to show in the Texas Landscape Project is that that things are not so simple, and that there are all these connections. And John Muir had this, great quote that and just was that if you pull on anything, and you'll find out that it's hooked up to everything else in the universe. And we're hoping that the 40-odd examples in the book give a lot of different examples of that may help people think a little bit more about how nature works in Texas.
And it's all integrated and interrelated.
One of my heroes is E.O. Wilson, and going back to the fire ants, he was a young man, maybe even adolescent, in Mobile, Alabama, and I believe he was one of the first people to see them in Mobile, Alabama. Hmm. He became a Harvard professor, and he's written a number of books. biophilia, the diversity of life, the naturalist, and I think your listeners would really love any of those books if they're not familiar with them already. One other thing I'll say about the fire ants is within the book, David found a picture of a close-up of a fire ant, and it looks ominous. It's a great picture, great visual.
Thank goodness they're not actually that large. They would be even more scary.
That's the stuff of horror movies.
And so I know we're kind of getting to the top of the hour here, but can you guys chime in, I guess, a little more about Austin? We were talking during the break a little bit about Barton Springs and the Hill Country area. I know you have an anecdote about that in the book as well.
We do talk about Barton Springs and development in the Barton Springs segment of the Edwards Aquifer. We were talking about the Hill Country earlier, and Austin is really on the cusp. It's on that line of the Hill Country to the Blackland Prairie and the Post Oak Savannah. So when we're thinking of West Austin, we are in the Hill Country, so we're already moving into there, and we need to understand, and one of the things that layering concept can help us understand is some of these environments are very sensitive. That karstic environment that supplies Barton Springs with that beautiful spring-fed water is very sensitive. So the development that we're doing out there, the results of that development, whether it come from more roads or more pet waste, that has an impact on Barton Springs itself. And that's something we're able to look at. We also have, just from an informational perspective, allowing people to understand how some of the cities are growing, looking at sprawl. And so there's a great series in there looking at development in 10-year segments in the Austin area, which I think is a great way to visualize and understand how the city is growing.
Yeah, it's hard to, I think, as people who live in a city, to realize that what you do has effect elsewhere. That's a big one I'm always trying to tell people, is that if you like Barton Springs, then you need to care about this development project that's happening very far away from it. And I think it's hard for people to see. Hopefully with some visualizing it, I think it would be very useful actually seeing it on the maps and tracing where these streams and rivers flow.
And I think a great example of that is SH 45 Southwest. I'm not sure how much you all have been able to talk about that on your show.
We have talked about it before. It's a hot issue for sure. And so remind people one more time, what's a good website to find out more about the Texas Landscape Project?
TexasLandscape.org. And then we'll be at Book People tonight at 7 p.m. We'd love to see people.
All right.
Great.
Well, I think that maybe does it for Shades of Green this week, and that's been our discussion of the Texas Landscape Project, David Todd and Jonathan Ogren, the co-authors. And so again, Texas Book People tonight, and have a good event.
Come see us, please.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And we're going to be talking about community solar next week. Is that right, John?
We are. We're going to talk about community solar. We're going to have hopefully maybe 3 or 4 guests, and each one of them somehow associated with a community solar project. Some of them will be returning guests. We'll have Leslie Libby as one.
Always a fun guest.
Always a fun guest. And so that's the plan. And the week after that, I will be away for a week. So this is vacation time. And so we'll have a pre-recorded show then.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening. This has been Shades of Green, John Hoffner, Amy Stansbury, and Reed Sternberg, with our guests David Todd and Jonathan Ogren.
You have been listening to Shades of Green, recorded live at KOOP 91.7 FM in Austin, Texas.